Mr. Suzuki.
May it please the court, good morning. I am Deputy Attorney General Russell Suzuki, representing Appellant Barbara Uphouse Wong, the Executive Director of the Hawaii Campaign Spending Commission. I'd like to recognize the presence of Mrs. Wong in the audience this morning.
Good morning. Mr. Suzuki, before we get into the substance of your argument, we noted that the Attorney General has filed an amicus curiae brief in this case, which appears to be directly adverse to your client's position in the case.
Yes.
It's an excellent brief, but it doesn't tell us how your client and the Attorney General have addressed what appears to be a conflict of interest.
For purposes of the conflict issue, we notified and the Campaign Spending Commission and Barbara Wong. We got her consent to waive the conflict or potential conflict. We also established a wall between in our office between my division and the Attorney General. And therefore, for purposes of this argument, the Attorney General has not supervised my writing of the brief or submission of the brief. It has been done independent of the Attorney General. The amicus brief was prepared and submitted by Charlene Aina, who was under the supervision of the Attorney General for that purpose.
Thank you for addressing that.
Thank you. The Maui Circuit Court strayed from applying the cardinal principles of statutory construction and accorded no deference to the administrative interpretation of the Campaign Spending Commission when it overturned the Campaign Spending Commission's interpretation of Hawaii Revised Statute Section 11-204. This is a case about a Maui mayoral election where out-of-state mainland corporations contributed over $1,000 of their corporate funds to the mayoral campaign of Charmaine Tavares. The Charmaine Tavares campaign interpreted Hawaii Revised Statutes 11-204A1C to allow more than $1,000 and up to $4,000 to be contributed to the Tavares campaign and gave that information to at least three corporations. The Tavares committee is a candidate committee and received $2,000 from Talboy Construction Incorporated, a corporation organized under the laws of Idaho, $2,000 from Kwong Enterprises, LLC, a limited liability company organized in California, and $1,000 from Cheeseburger in Paradise, Inc., and $1,000 from Cheeseburger in Paradise, Waikiki, both organized under the laws of California. Hawaii Revised Statutes 11-204, which sets forth the campaign spending limits, provides that no person or any other entity shall make contributions to a candidate seeking nomination or election to a four-year non-statewide office or to a candidate's committee in an aggregate amount greater than $4,000 during an election period. Section B of that statute provides that no person or any other entity shall make contributions to a non-candidate committee in an aggregate amount greater than $1,000 in an election.
And this was a contribution to a candidate committee, correct?
Yes, the Charmaine Tavares committee.
Which would be A, not B, correct?
Yes.
Well, my question was, who are the non-candidate committees involved in this case?
In this particular case, it's the Kwong Enterprises, the intervener below.
And can you walk me through that, through the statute, to tell me how they are characterized as a non-candidate?
Okay. I believe we start with Hawaii Revised Statutes 11-191, which is the broad definition of what a committee is. Let me just find that reference. Any organization, association, or individual that makes an expenditure or accepts a contribution under the definition of committee under the campaign spending rules. And we believe that Kwong Enterprise would fit under that broad definition of what a committee is for purposes of registration and disclosure. Unfortunately, what the court did below was to carve out an exception for entities like Kwong Enterprises, so that, as interpreted by the Maui Circuit Court, entities such as Kwong would not even be required to submit any kind of registration as a committee and would not be subject to that definition of the committee. So basically what the Maui court did was carved out an exception to the definition, which is broad, would submit, of what a committee is, by excluding from that definition entities like Kwong Enterprises, so that they would be able to contribute unfettered and not have to make any registration reporting as a committee.
Mr. Suzuki, is it your position that every non-individual that makes a campaign contribution of any kind becomes a non-candidate committee by making that contribution?
Yes. Well, I believe the threshold is $1,000, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. But I'm just focusing on the definition.
Yes.
So every non-individual that makes a contribution thereby becomes a non-candidate committee. Is that right?
That's correct. Because okay. The definition is so broad. It's any organization, association, or individual. So it's a very broad definition. And I think the purpose of this capture is to allow both a disclosure of the reporting of the contribution as well as a reporting of that contribution by the campaign committee itself, so that you have a cross-check between the two entities for purposes of public disclosure.
Okay, but before we get to disclosure issues or purpose issues, under your interpretation, would any person other than an individual ever be able to make a contribution under 11-204A?
I believe a candidate can make unlimited contribution of their own personal funds.
Okay, but a candidate is still an individual. So
right.
Any non-individual?
No.
So the meaning of person under 11-191
includes corporations.
But
or any other entity.
Right, but 11-204A talks about persons being able to make contributions.
But, the definition of person is similarly broad to include not only an individual human being, but also other entities as well.
Isn't that somewhat inconsistent, though?
Perhaps, and I guess that would suggest also that there is an ambiguity in the statute itself, which is our basic proposition, that because of that ambiguity, you need to look at the legislative history and other extrinsic evidence to glean what the legislature intended.
Alternatively, but maybe that's not what the statute means.
Well, I think in reviewing and preparing for today's argument, I did notice the distinction in Chapter 204, which I don't believe we briefed in our submitted or highlighted in our briefs. But the point that I wanted to suggest to the court today was that if you look at 11-204, for purposes of the A1C, it talks about contributions greater than $4,000 during an election period, whereas in Section B, it talks about the limitation of the $1,000 in aggregate amount greater than $1,000 in an election. And I think if you look at the definition in 11-191 between what an election is and an election period is, I think it makes rational sense as to why the legislature designed the statute in this fashion. What this contemplates is that for any one election, you're limited to the $1,000 cap. But in an election period, which could include a primary election, a general election, special elections in the event that somebody might have, the winner of the election might have passed away and a special election might be required to be called, during that election period, you can aggregate $1,000 contributions, but no more than $4,000. So I think if you look at it that way, there is some rationality to the statute, but there's clear difference between the appellee's position of unfettered $4,000 contribution, regardless of whether it's an election or an election period. And I think the commission wants to stress that there is clear distinctions in the definition itself as between what an election is and an election period is.
Mr. Suzuki,
yes.
After the Maui court ruling against the Campaign Spending Commission,
yes.
Did the commission ask the legislature to clarify this or to amend the statute?
I believe it did. And what happened, though, is that the legislature did not address the matter. You know, as far as, like, suggesting any motives, I mean, I hate to go down the political route, but it would appear to me, this is my personal observation, that at the time that the restriction was imposed, you were facing a strong Republican candidate for governor who is raising campaign contributions. But that time has passed. And if you're looking at it today, perhaps the legislature is looking at this unfettered ability to get more contributions as something that might favor candidates other than
the motive of legislators may or may not be. They certainly could have enacted a law clarifying it.
That's true, and they did not.
Mr. Suzuki,
yes.
Did the commission either cite or give notice that the plaintiff contributors in this case were in violation of the law by not registering or not filing reports?
I believe so. I believe the executive director sent letters to Quan Enterprises and Tallboy to inform them that they needed to register and that they needed to return the, or that they made contributions in excess. But because of that dispute at the administrative level, that's why a lawsuit was filed in the circuit court in Maui.
So that's the letter that's at issue here, the letter telling them that they could not contribute more than $1,000.
I believe so, yes. But and there were also, I believe, telephone conversations or communications by the executive director to all of the parties regarding this matter before the lawsuit was filed.
Okay, and so because the lawsuit was filed, no further action was taken, is that?
Yes, I believe so. The Maui, as I said, the Maui court completely ignored the operative words during an election period and in an election. Also, the Maui court completely ignored the definition of a committee, which I had suggested before that what the definition is broad, but yet what the court did was to say that these entities who make contributions of $2,000 were not committees for purposes of registration and therefore could make those contributions without disclosure or registration for the Campaign Spending Commission. What this means then is that there is a judicial gloss to the definition of what a committee is that I believe was not intended by the legislature. The legislature, if you look at what the philosophy and the legislative history of campaign spending disclosure is, it is a disclosure requirement so that the public can see who contributes to which candidates and there's transparency in the election process.
Mr. Suzuki, but even if we agree with the Tavares campaign's position, all contributions by Kwong and Cheeseburger, they're reported to the commission anyway, right?
That
by
is
the
correct.
Campaign.
But
and they're reported by the commission to the public, aren't they?
They're become public records of, but that's the reporting by the candidates' committee that they received the contribution.
But it's not secret, right?
It's not a secret, but what the process we believe requires is that there's a check on this so that you can check the contributions from the contributions received by the candidates committee as well as with the contributions that are made by the non-candidate committee so that there's full disclosure on both sides and there's a cross-check between the two entities.
Is that spelled out in the statute or the legislative history?
I believe so, and I believe I will probably get to that when I go through. What I wanted to do was give a chronology of the changes in the legislation during that time, and I believe I have some citations to some congressional legislative testimony that might support that proposition. In 1981, the definition of a committee was amended by adding a $1,000 threshold before triggering the reporting requirements for campaign spending disclosure. During the debates on the floor of the Senate, it was noted that The change now mandates all committees, including unions and corporations as defined in this section, making expenditures in the aggregate of more than $1,000 per election to influence the nomination and election of candidates or ballot questions on issues to file reports as required by law. So I believe that suggested when the legislature enacted the initial campaign spending laws that all committees, including those that make contribution to candidate committees, were required to make to register. In 1987, the legislature amended the definition of committee to require a committee whose sole activity consists of direct contributions to candidates in an aggregate amount of in excess of $1,000 to submit statements of contributions in lieu of filing mandatory reporting. In 1995, the definition of a non-candidate committee was added to distinguish between a candidate's committee and a non-candidate or issue committee and to impose reporting requirements. That's Act 18 in 1995. In 1995, the legislature also imposed contribution limitations on depending on the office sought. So if you ran for a four-year office, the ability to contribute more as opposed to a two-year office. In 1997, the legislature closed the loophole regarding the sole electoral activity, and in so doing, accepted from this requirement corporations who use monies directly from their treasury from the $1,000 limit. This was Act 375. However, in 2005, which appellant highlights as the most critical amendment to this analysis, the legislature repealed the exception that corporations enjoyed if they used monies directly from their treasury. As a result of this appeal, following the 2005 amendment, corporations who contribute directly from their treasury were not to be exempted from the more than $1,000 limitation. This was Act 203 in 2005. We believe that the Maui court failed to glean the importance of this 2005 amendment and also failed to give administrative deference to the Campaign Spending Commission. You know, the Campaign Spending Commission is one of those unique administrative agencies like the State Ethics Commission and the Office of Information Practices, where the legislature bestows upon them the authority and power to issue advisory opinions interpreting how they administer their statutes.
But ultimately, it's for the court to determine.
I agree. Ultimately, it's for the court. But I believe that they deserve a little more deference in the hierarchy of respect, as opposed to an ordinary administrative agency that does not have this authority.
As far as Hawaii Revised Statutes 11-204, if the court concludes that statute's clear on its face and is dispositive, then the legislative history doesn't matter, does it?
Yes, I concede that point. But I also would suggest that within the two sections, there is distinctive words such as per election and election period that I think would then compel you to support the position of the Campaign Spending Commission.
The thing that gets me, Mr. Suzuki, is that when I read 11-204, we're talking about a contribution to a candidate committee.
Yes.
And clearly, the committee that received the contribution in this case was a candidate committee.
Yes.
Isn't that it?
But I believe the way that it's, I think the hard part to comprehend is that all committees, all corporations, before they can make a contribution under the interpretation of the Campaign Spending Commission, and we believe what Chapter 11 suggests is that before you can make that contribution from a non-candidate committee to a candidate's committee, you first must organize as a committee and basically administratively remove the funds from the treasury of the corporation into this committee before it can then be transferred or contributed to the candidates' committee.
So the issue you're interested in is not the contribution to the Tavares campaign, but the corporation's transfer of funds within the corporation.
To begin with, yes. We believe that they missed that first step. And if they were required to do that, there would be transparency in the process because they would be registering as a committee, non-candidate committee, filing reports to the Campaign Spending Commission on their...
What does the sort of phrase under 11204A mean, you know, other entity? I mean, it certainly says, A, that an entity can make a $4,000 contribution to a candidate committee. But under your interpretation, it couldn't, because an entity would be a non-candidate committee and could only give $1,000, right?
Yes, because I believe you have to read that section with the other section, and collectively you would be limited to a $4,000 contribution, but per election you would be limited to a $1,000 contribution.
Thank you. Crockett?
May it please the court. As the members of the panel have already observed, this case really turns on an interpretation of these statutes. I do, however, want to start with one basic fact, and that is the fact, the critical fact here, is that there was a payment made by Kwong, the Charmaine Tavares campaign. That is a candidate committee. That's not a non-candidate committee. The statute that's being relied upon that questions that transaction, of course, is 204B, which refers to a contribution to a non-candidate committee. Now, it seems to me that's, as been pointed out and as we indicated in our brief, that really is the end of the discussion, because the actual contribution was made to a candidate committee. Now then, how does the commission reach the theory or reach the point where this contribution made by these three entities to the candidate committee violated 204B? Well, they reached that by this sort of an analysis where they say all funds got to pass through a non-candidate committee. All funds must come through a non-candidate committee before it can go to a committee. And incidentally, the question that was posed as to why we can exclude everybody except individuals from this definition of a non-candidate committee. Well, if you follow the definitions that are set forth in the statute, you cannot make that exclusion, because an individual is included in the definition of a committee. Therefore, an individual is included in the definition of a non-candidate committee. And an individual then can be a non-candidate committee under the definitions that are set out in the statute. So following through in that line of thought, there is no rational distinction for excluding individuals such as sole proprietors from this comprehensive definition of a non-candidate committee.
Did any of the entities in this case have a non-candidate committee through which the money passed?
No, and that brings it to the crux of the, I think, of the case and the crux of the statute. What did the legislature really intend to regulate by this definition of a non-candidate committee and the contribution limits imposed upon a non-candidate committee and the reporting requirements of a non-candidate committee? What were they really trying to get at? Well, I think the answer is pretty simple. They were trying to get at public, what are called PACs, public action committees. That's what they were really trying to regulate. They weren't trying to impose comprehensive regulations upon businesses, whether those businesses are conducted as corporations, limited liability companies, partnerships, or as sole proprietors. They were really trying to regulate PACs. And if you keep that in mind, then these statutes hang together and really do make sense.
Mr. Crockett, so if I understand correctly, what the circuit court said is under 204, persons can contribute to a candidate committee or a non-candidate committee. When it's a candidate committee, 204A applies. When it's a non-candidate committee, 204B applies. And right. It's that simple.
I think it is that simple. And when you think of it in terms of the legislature's plan to regulate PACs, then the 204B limitation to say that an individual, a corporation, a partnership, when you're contributing to a PAC, your contribution is limited to $1,000. Now, that doesn't mean that a person who wants to make a contribution cannot make contribution to a number of PACs, and the PAC, in turn, can make contributions to the candidate committees. When you look at it and think of it in those terms, the statute hangs together, and it does make sense. But it doesn't make any sense, the interpretation that's being given it, given the statute, A and B, makes no sense at all when you try to say that 204B is intended to limit the contributions that businesses, and that's the phrase that they're using, businesses can make. And there's no definition of businesses in the statute. There's nothing in the legislative history that would suggest that businesses as some sort of a classification over and apart from the classifications that are defined in the statute were intended to be treated differently. I would like to turn very briefly to the question about administrative deference. I think it's important to note, as we did in our briefs, that there's really nothing in the record that shows that the commission itself has adopted this interpretation of the of these statutes. But in any event, it would seem to me that if the commission was serious about this interpretation of the statute, they would have proposed it in the form of a rule, which of course would have had to have been approved by a governor. And it seems to me if that had practice had been followed, we certainly wouldn't have had, well, I don't know how the governor or whoever it might have been would have looked at it, but it seems to me that that's the form of administrative procedure rulemaking which really should have been followed if the commission was serious about taking this tack to the statute. In any event, if you get over that point, you still get to the bottom line on this question of deference. You're interpreting a statute. When the statute is plain and clear on its face, the courts are not required to give administrative deference to the statute. I would like to say briefly, make a few brief comments about this question of the federal, how this case interacts with a federal constitutional decision that was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Randall case. Before
we get to that, sure. I wouldn't mind if we went back to this idea of what's a committee, what's a non-candidate committee, what's a candidate committee. How many kinds of committees are there under this statute? Are there two? Are there three? Are there more? Is it just, are every committee under the statute either a non-candidate committee or a candidate committee, or is there a third alternative?
I don't see any third classification under statute, and none has been suggested.
Okay. So is Quang a committee?
Quang did not form a committee. Quang could have formed the committee.
And Quang itself is not a committee under the statute?
No, Quang is not a committee.
Okay.
Quang is not a non-candidate committee. That seems to me pretty clear. Quang was organized because one of the changes that was made in the law in 05 was to give some focus to the definition of a non-candidate committee, and they said that a non-candidate committee had to have as its purpose the raising of funds, and that was added
Right, and the purpose part of the definition of non-candidate committee, that modifies the purpose of the committee, not the purpose of the contribution. Is that correct?
I think that's pretty clear, yeah. And I want to point out also that when you're talking about organizational purposes, it seems to me they're taking the tack that since a contribution was made by Quang, that somehow that meant that their purpose was to make contributions. Well, not at all. Their purpose, as stated in their organizational documents, was to develop shopping centers. And the fact that they made a contribution doesn't mean that their purpose then became one of making political contributions. It's the difference between an organizational purpose and the organizational powers.
Yeah, but I thought their argument was it doesn't matter what the purpose of the organization is, it's the purpose of the contribution that turns it into a non-candidate committee.
Well, I don't see that. I didn't understand their argument quite like that, but
okay.
Let's assume that that is their argument. In the definition of the candidate committee, they're talking about a purpose, and it seems to be that language is included in the definition of a non-candidate committee, so it must be, it seems to me, that you're talking about the purpose of the organization, not the purpose of the contribution. Now, there's no question a contribution's got the purpose of advancing the political ambitions of the person to whom you're making the contribution. There's no question about that.
Okay.
But
thanks.
I do think, I thought that they were making the point that somehow because you have a purpose stated in the organizational documents, the fact that the organization then makes a campaign contribution, that somehow means that the organizational purposes have been expanded upon. I think there you're looking at corporate law, if you will, distinguishing between organizational purposes and organizational powers. And there has been no question that the donation was ultra vires and beyond the powers of the organization. I just want to say something very briefly about the federal constitutional aspects of this case, that if you follow their interpretation of this statute, then everybody, and I think everybody includes individuals because that's the way the non-candidate committee language is drafted, everybody is then limited to a $1,000 contribution for all candidates in a given election. Now, I agree that the given election, you can bifurcate the general from the primary, but at that point, a person who wants to make contributions is limited in their ability to make contributions to $1,000 for each election. And I think when you read the Randall case, you've got a real federal constitutional question. And I think you then have to look at the interpretation that they're giving this statute, and you have to say, well, is there a rational interpretation to the statute which avoids these constitutional questions, which I think should be followed, or are we going to go down the road where we're adopting an interpretation of the statute which runs smack dab into the Randall case?
But if this court concludes there's no non-candidate committee at play in this case, then we never get to the constitutional issue.
I agree. I have no further questions, unless the court has some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Crockett. Mr. Suzuki?
Just address the constitutional issue that was raised that I didn't address in my argument. The appellant's position is that statutes are presumptively constitutional, and a challenger has the burden of establishing beyond a reasonable doubt the unconstitutionality of a statute. I believe Schwab versus Ariyoshi and Blair versus Cayetano, those lines of cases support that proposition. But in any event, the Maui court did not address the constitutional issues and did not apply the Sorrell analysis, the five-part test. So in that event, we would ask that if the court is inclined to go down that road to remand the matter back to the Maui court to apply and do the constitutional analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Suzuki. Nothing further. The court will take it under advisement. Thank you very much.